are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, October 30th. I'm Rachel from Drake University. Here is our first story. This first article is titled, Safety First, Trick-or-Treaters Asked to Prioritize Health. Parents allowing their children to participate in Halloween festivities this year amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic are encouraged to take various safety precautions, according to the information provided by Iowa Department of Public Health officials. Trick-or-treaters, provided information says, should limit the number of houses they visit, and children should maintain at least 6 feet of distance from tree-givers. Adults are also encouraged to hold the bags of small children to ensure overall safety. Other safety precautions include only accepting factory-wrapped treats and avoiding homemade treats by strangers. Wipe off candy wrappers with sanitizing wipes upon arriving home. If a child is at greater risk of complications from COVID-19, parents and guardians are asked to contact their family doctor before permitting their child to go trick-or-treating. Stay local. Avoid the urge to attend events in other towns, as it could lead to the greater spread of the virus. Think before you go. Visit the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website to access what's best for you and your family when it comes to celebrating this year. Get vaccinated against the flu. Consider getting the flu vaccine before Halloween to stay healthier overall. Although the flu vaccine does not protect one against the coronavirus, it minimizes the overall risk of getting sick or being hospitalized from the flu. For those handing out candy, provide children with individual treats or goodie bags rather than having kids put their hands into a candy bowl. Thoroughly wash, sanitize hands before enjoying any treats collected. According to information provided by the Nebraska Regional Poison Center in Omaha, all costumes should be warm, well-fitting, and non-flammable. A surgical mask or cloth face covering should be incorporated into this costume. A costume mask is not a substitute for cloth mask, organization representatives said. For more safety tips, visit idph.iowa.gov. Also on the topic of Halloween, this next article is called Halloween Activities in the Bluffs. Though a wrench has likely been thrown into many residents' Halloween plans, there are still a handful of activity offerings happening in the Bluffs this holiday season. Activities include, from 6:15 to 11 p.m. today, Halloween Eve candlelight tours are being held at the historic General Dodge House, 605 South 3rd Street. The event costs $15 and masks are required. The 20-minute tour begins at the adjacent Bersheim House, and then participants will head next door to the Dodge House, according to information from the Council Bluffs Convention and Visitors Bureau. Participants will experience the house with lighting similar to 150 years ago. Attendees will be sent home with a goodie bag. For more information, contact Michelle Herdrica at 712-322-2406. The Rocky Horror Picture Show. Viewing and costume contests are being held today at the Mid-America Center in Council Bluffs, one arena away. In the production, newlyweds Brad and Janet find themselves lost and cold on a rainy night. The madcap musical mayhem begins when the couple takes refuge in the castle of Dr. Frank Nifferter, as he is about to unleash his greatest creation and have a bit of fun with his reluctant guests. Participants are encouraged to dress up as their favorite Transylvanian and participate in the costume contest. Doors open at 8 p.m., followed by 9 p.m. costume contest and 10 p.m. screening. For more information, contact Rob McCracken at 712-326-2282. Halloween at the Brewery is being held throughout the day, Saturday at the Full Fredge Brewery, 40 Arena Way, Suite Number 2. Happy Hour prices are being offered for attendees' first beer of the day, and spooky music will be played during the duration of the day and night. 4 p.m. kicks off with kid-friendly activities, including crafting a mummy pumpkin and individualized goodie bags with trick-or-treat candy. All crafts will be socially distanced, and goodie bags will be individually wrapped. At 7 p.m., the Bloody Barbarian beer returns in all of its gory glory, small-batched, limited release. At 9 p.m., the winner will be announced for the adult costume contest. The winner gets free beer. For more information, contact Desi Redmond at 712-828-2018. An adult costume contest is being held from 8 to 10:30 p.m. Saturday at Caddy's Kitchen and Cocktails, 103 West Broadway. For more information, contact 712-256-0070. Halloween Cosmic Bowling is being held from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. Saturday at Thunderbolt of Council Bluffs, 1900 Madison Avenue. Attendees are being asked to wear a costume to have a chance to win $30 for best costume or $20 for second best. For more information, contact Connie Ratliff at 712-328-2374. The Haunted Council Bluffs pop-up art show is being held through Saturday in the foyer of the park building, 500 Willow Avenue. The event, presented by Wendy's Kitchen Boutique, features work from artist Darren Richardson and Silver Angel Photography and Illustration. Richardson's comic book-styled work depicts several spooky tales and urban legends from Council Bluffs. The work celebrates the rich history of the area and takes a lighthearted and fun view on some of our historic locations. Learn about the spooky paranormal legends from the Squirrel Cage Jail, historic General Dodge House, the haunted cannons at the Kinsman Monument, and more. Access to the park building foyer will stop at 7:30 p.m. each evening. Next, we have an article titled American Legion Post 2 Leasing Bar to External Operator. Money will help fund programs. Veterans and other patrons may have seen a new face at American Legion Rainbow Post No. 2 lately. Todd Gokenour is now running the bar as a separate entity, according to CMDR Charlene Anderson. He is leasing that area from the Post. We're still here. We own the building and we're still running our programs, she said. He's helped us get donations. He's donated himself. An entrance to the building that faces 9th Avenue, once covered up, has been reopened so veterans can enter the Post meeting room directly, which is currently undergoing some improvements, Anderson said. The American Legion Post's sign is now over the new entrance. Everybody will have a code to get in, she said. We just need to get a light over here. The whole building's going to get a paint job in the spring. We've got a few panels we need to take care of first. Gokenour started leasing the bar on September 11th, Anderson said. Todd approached us to use our building, she said. He offered to come in and take over the bar. We have a steady income now, and we don't have to worry about it. Now all of our money can go into our programs. The COVID-19 pandemic had a devastating effect on the bar, Anderson said. We were running 7 days a week before COVID. Then we were closed for 3 months, she said. Then we opened back up and we weren't making enough to operate it, said Gokenour. I leased the bar to take the burden off of them. Gokenour updated the bar and opened it to the public, he said. He purchased 6 new pool tables, 4 new dartboards, a new jukebox, and a new coin machine, he said. He also painted some of the interior walls. Traffic is slowly returning, he said. This brought the younger crowd in, he said. Gokenour has also been informing patrons that they don't necessarily have to be in the military to join the Legion. They only have to be the spouse or descendant of someone who served, said Anderson. We've had a lot of people sign up since he came. Monday night, I was able to go to some patrons and signed 3 people up. Gokenour has also started youth pool leagues for people ages 10 to 21, he said. Other youth can play from 3 to 6:30 p.m. weekdays, then league play starts. The pool hall is also open to the public from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Anyone younger than 21 must be accompanied by an adult. The pool tables will be or the pool tables will be moved to allow room for lunch that traditionally follows the Council Bluffs Veterans Day Parade, Anderson says. If all goes well, we'll have a big party for the Army-Navy game in December, she added. Todd's going to help us out with that as well. This next article is titled, Iowa's Top Election Official Lays Out Security Strategy. Iowa's top elections officials, joined by state and federal law enforcement and emergency management leaders, wants Iowans to feel confident in their ability to vote safely and securely in this election. Iowa's Secretary of State Paul Pate held a news conference Thursday at the State Emergency Operations Center to deliver a message of reassurance to Iowa voters. We're working with the state and federal partners to strengthen Iowa's election security and infrastructure and to prepare for any kind of situation that might arise on Election Day, Pate said. We're ready for next Tuesday. That's the message, and we want to make sure everyone is comfortable and confident. With early voting underway and the November election less than a week away, election-related concerns range hacking attempts and disinformation campaigns by hostile foreign countries to an avalanche of ballots cast before Election Day. Pate said his office has been working with a myriad of state and federal officials, as well as the auditors in all 99 Iowa counties, to ensure a safe and secure election. I can't emphasize this enough. The integrity of the vote and the safety of the voters are my top priorities, Pate said. The sanctity of the vote must be protected, and we are committing vast resources to ensure that happens. So you can go out there and make your voice heard, and make sure that you're a voter. Pate was joined at Thursday's news conference by leaders with the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the Iowa Department of Public Safety, the Iowa National Guard, the Federal Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI. Pate said many of those same agencies will have staff at the State Emergency Operations Center throughout Election Day in order to respond to any issues across the state. It makes me sleep better at night because I know I've got the whole team backing up what we're going to be doing on Election Day, Pate said. Each agency's leader described the preparations they have been making in order to help ensure a smooth Election Day or respond to crises if they arrive. The leaders described efforts to protect state elected officials from cyber attacks and preparations for being ready to respond to Election Day incidents. Pate stressed that even with the relentless amount of hacking attempts on state agencies, Iowa voters should be comforted by the fact votes are cast on paper ballots. You can't hack a paper ballot, Pate said. Somebody sitting in Moscow or Beijing is not going to be able to do that. The next story is called Blink Wi-Fi Celebrates 5 Years Online. In October 2015, the City of Council Bluffs and Council Bluffs Schools, with support of key partners such as Iowa West Foundation and Google, launched Phase 1 of a free public Wi-Fi initiative, Blink, at the Charles E. Lakin Human Services Campus. Blink's mission: to provide internet access wherever technically and financially feasible that would not only allow students to connect to their classrooms at home, but also for residents to boost their connectivity to resources, opportunities, and each other. 5 years and five phases later, Blink is now available in a multitude of Council Bluffs neighborhoods, all of the Council Bluffs schools buildings, and many outdoor spaces such as Gail Wickersham Athletic Complex, the Council Bluffs Rec Complex, and Bayless Park. More expansion is coming soon. Partnerships. Funding for Blink continues to be a community-wide effort. To date, no tax dollars have been used to offer this amenity to the community. Blink partners include Google, Iowa West Foundation, Charles E. Lakin Foundation, Echo Group, Mid-American Energy, Miller Electric, Ruckus Wireless, SmartWave Technologies, Unite Private Networks, Bluffs Electric, City of Carter Lake, and OPPD. This project is a great example of public-private partnerships, said Mayor Matt Walsh. Without the support of Google, Iowa West Foundation, and Council Bluffs Schools, Bluffs Community Wi-Fi would not be possible. Access to reliable Wi-Fi is critical for academic success, especially this year, said Brendan Mainwaring, Iowa West Foundation President and CEO. Blink truly sets our community apart as it helps thousands of students in Council Bluffs to learn and allows our community to connect. We are proud to continue our support for this cutting-edge partnership. Launch and expansion. The launch of Phase 1 from 14th Street, 23rd Street, north of Broadway, encompassed the Lincoln Campus and Wilson Middle School. Since that time, the coverage has expanded to add 5 more phases in 5 years, westward to 35th Street and as far south as 9th Avenue. Phases 6 and 7 are underway, with expected completion dates of later 2020 and early 2021, respectively. The Blink project has grown exponentially in a short time. This is thanks to unusual cooperation between the school district, the City of Council Bluffs and Carter Lake, the Iowa West Foundation, and Google, said Dave Fringer, Wi-Fi Consortium Governance Committee member. This project is a great example of how private-public partnerships can change communities for the better. Blink's Wi-Fi network in Council Bluffs is helping local kids across the internet so they can continue their education, said Dan Harbeck, head of public policy and external affairs at Google. Internet accessibility is a priority for Google in our home communities, like Council Bluffs, and we're proud to support Blink's effort to ensure students and our community's workforce have the tools they need to be successful. COVID impact. Back in March, the COVID-19 pandemic exacerbated the challenges for students and families without internet access. Thanks to grant funding from the Southwest Iowa COVID-19 Response Fund, an initiative of the Iowa West Foundation and Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, along with contributions from Peter Kiewit Foundation and the City of Council Bluffs totaling $400,000, CBCSD was able to leverage CARES Act funding to accelerate planning connectivity expansions in the Rue and Longfellow elementary school neighborhoods. Funding from Google and the Iowa West Foundation also expanded Blink to the students and families who live in Carter Lake. Blink Wi-Fi coverage thus expanded 17%, providing access to nearly 1,500 more students. Our students and families are fortunate to be part of a truly connected community. We value this unique Blink partnership to make internet services available so our students can use their Chromebooks to access their learning materials and connect with their teachers and classmates while at home, said Dr. Vicky Murillo, superintendent of the Council Bluffs Community School District. With each new phase, our community can proudly say that we are removing barriers so that students will continue to thrive in their learning. Blink is a tremendous asset for our school district, said John Stile, Chief Technology Officer of Council Bluffs Community School District. We are very fortunate to have a tremendous relationship with the City of Council Bluffs and more recently the City of Carter Lake, in addition to Google and the Iowa West Foundation, who continue to assist in support in so many different ways. These partnerships do not exist in other cities, and they are what makes Blink so very special. What's next? At the completion of Phase 7, the Blink coverage area will reach more than 5.5 square miles, providing Wi-Fi access to more than 7,600 students in Council Bluffs schools, and reaching the doorsteps of many homes in the Council Bluffs area. Blink will eventually be one of the most extensive free community Wi-Fi networks in the United States. The partners' continued commitment to this project demonstrates the vision for community-wide access and growth. We are moving on to today's face of the day. Pictured is Derek Runyans. Derek Runyans is using his high school experience to help map out his future. Derek, 14, was born and raised in Council Bluffs, and he is currently a freshman at Thomas Jefferson High School. He attended Franklin Elementary School and Wilson Middle School before arriving at TJ. A couple of months into his high school experience, Derek said things were going pretty well. He said he was bummed to have to finish middle school virtually due to COVID-19 pandemic, so it's nice to be back in person with his friends and peers. He said it was a little strange taking the step up and going to a new school with so many safety measures in place, but he's getting along fine. I guess this is just the new normal for now, he said. Derek said he is quickly noticing the difference between middle school and high school. He said he likes having the freedom to choose from a variety of elective classes and said he can't wait for next semester to take business and cooking courses. He loves working in the kitchen, and he's always down to grill a nice T-bone steak. He is also interested in running his own business someday. So he said taking relevant classes will help shape his career path. On a less vital note, Derek said the food is way better at TJ, the teachers are really nice, and that there are a lot more stairs than there are at Wilson. Derek loves sports, and he is looking forward to competing in Yellow Jacket athletics over the next 4 years. He participates in open gyms almost daily, and he will soon be playing basketball this upcoming season. Baseball is his favorite sport, and he is excited to start slugging next summer. He is a fan of college baseball and always enjoys experiencing a game or two during the College World Series across the river. It was canceled last summer due to the pandemic, so he's hoping to make the trip next year if things are closer to normal. His high school experience has only just begun, and Derek is excited for all the opportunities ahead of him. Looking to some outdoor news, this article is called Learn to Hunt Program Opens Registration for Virtual Squirrel and Rabbit Hunting Workshop. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is offering a free virtual workshop to teach skills needed to hunt, field dress, and cook squirrel and rabbit to individuals who have little to no hunting experience. This virtual workshop consists of one online knowledge and skills building session with instructors that possess the experience to teach skills necessary to become efficient small game hunters. For those interested in the small game hunting as a means of sourcing their own protein, this provides the opportunity to learn the skills and knowledge it takes to do it all yourself, says Jamie Cook, program coordinator with the Iowa DNR. Participants will learn basic strategies for hunting squirrels and rabbits, such as proper equipment, where to hunt, safe shooting practices, how to field dress, clean, and cook small game. The course is geared for participants 16 and older. Those under 16 must have an adult register and participate in the course as well. Space online will be limited, so register right away to ensure your spot. The course will be held November 10th and will cover topics such as habitat and biology, hunting regulation, strategies, equipment, and cooking. The program is provided through a partnership with backcountry hunters and anglers and the Iowa DNR. It is part of a national effort to recruit, retain, and reactivate hunters due to the decline in hunting and outdoor recreation. Fall is a great time to catch fish in Iowa's rivers. Enjoy Iowa's natural landscape, fishing Iowa's rivers and streams this fall. A unique angling challenge is hidden around every bend. You are never far from one of Iowa's many rivers, said Greg Gelwicks, Iowa DNR Interior River Research Biologist. Fall is a great time to give them a try. Fish become more active and hungry when the stream temperature drops. Look for actively feeding fish where riffles enter pools and rocky areas, Gelwick says. They sit there out in the current and wait for the food to come by. Many fish in Iowa's rivers search out deep pools with very little current to spend the winter. Fish start to move to overwintering areas in October, and most fish will arrive by November. Anglers willing to brave chilly temperatures can be rewarded if they seek out those areas, Gelwick says. Channel catfish will move to the deepest holes they can find in larger streams, often with depths greater than 15 feet, if available. Walleyes can be found in the same pools, but will also use slightly shallower areas with little current. Look for smallmouth bass in deep holes with boulders or woody structures. When fish first move to the wintering holes, deep running crankbaits and jigs with plastics work well. As water temperatures drop, switch to a jig and minnow fished slowly for best results. Try the upper Wapsinicon River, Buchanan and Lynn counties, or upper Cedar River. Black Hawk and Bremer counties for smallmouth bass, the Shell Rock River, Butler and Bremer counties, or upper Cedar Rivers, Black Hawk or Bremer counties, are a great choice for walleye. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, October 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Rachel from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. This next article is an opinion piece. It is called Our View, Biden is the Best Candidate for America. President Donald Trump has not shown any ability to lead this country, and as such does not deserve a second term. It's not just the policies, of which many of Trump's have been harmful to the country, it's the norm-breaking, the vitriol for anyone who deigns to disagree with him, the countless conspiracy theories, and in tandem with his propensity for conspiracy theories, his never-ending grievance politics. His everyone is out to get me shtick. It's also exhausting. Former President Joe Biden will listen to science and provide clear-cut national guidance on the COVID-19 pandemic. Biden will not peddle misinformation about the novel coronavirus. Biden has shown he takes the pandemic seriously, putting him ahead of the current president. Biden will, again, listen to scientists when it comes to climate change and environmental policy. Biden will work to protect and expand the Affordable Care Act, an imperfect bill that nevertheless provides protections for those with pre-existing conditions and is a concrete health policy, something Trump, despite promises for almost 4 years, has yet to provide the American people. And Biden will work to restore the United States' standing in the world, working with our allies to make the world and in turn the U.S. a safer place. The list of Trump's missteps, reasons to not give him another 4 years, is long. Not doing enough regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, his failures to include downplaying the severity early, refuting his top doctors and scientists in public comments and on Twitter, holding rallies where the campaign's claim of taking precautions ring hollow when you see the photos and videos, countless people without masks and little social distancing, making fun of anyone, including his opponent, for taking basic precautions to protect themselves and others, saying media coverage of COVID-19 will end on November 4th, amplifying conspiracy theories about unproven cures in the hospital, inflating death counts. The result is 228,000 deaths from the disease in the United States, with no end in sight. And of course, it's not Trump's fault that the pandemic occurred. Each death isn't on him, but that number dwarfs the per capita death rates for the majority of first world countries, which have embraced the advice of doctors and scientists instead of standing athwart them and kept numbers down ahead of recent surges. Rolling back environmental protections, a USA Today report noted nearly 100 environmental rollbacks the Trump administration had pursued over the past 4 years to loosen regulations on everything from air quality to wildlife. This isn't just about climate change, which Trump seems to not to believe in. It's about air quality, too, and protecting wildlife preserves from unwarranted drilling when the country is, in fact, shifting toward renewable energy in a profitable and sustainable way. Conspiracy theorist in chief, Trump's affinity for conspiracy theories predate his election, the most prominent of which was his tireless efforts pushing the debunked theory that his predecessor, Barack Obama, was not born in the United States. As president, Trump has made a habit of attacking elections and voting. It started with his baseless claim that he would have won the 2016 popular vote if not for cheating in California or New York. This year, he's attacked mail-in voting as rife with fraud, despite little to no evidence of such among states that have been for years conducted mail-in voting. There's more. The since ended ban on travel from Muslim countries, banning transgender soldiers from the military, denying countless people the chance to defend and serve their country. And on top of this, Trump has lined his own pockets while in office. The Washington Post reported Tuesday that since 2017, $2.5 million in taxpayer money has been spent at Trump-owned hotels and resorts. To paraphrase the Democratic nominee, here's the deal. Joe Biden is far from a perfect candidate. We believe a perfect candidate doesn't exist, just as a perfect human does not exist. We are all fallible. Biden is who voters in the Democratic Party chose to put up against President Trump. When stacked up against his opponent, Biden is a clear choice. When the election is over, our country will remain divided. It's a division we hope will narrow in the coming years. We believe the former vice president has the better poise and policies to lead our country toward bridging that gap. For our obituaries, we have two for today. The first is Patsy Ann Trent Warner. Patsy Ann Trent Warner, age 83, passed away October 27, 2020, at Rising Sun Christian Village in Council Bluffs. Patsy was born September 9, 1937, in Council Bluffs to the late Roscoe and Hazel. She graduated in 1955 from Thomas Jefferson High School. She became a CPA and worked for over 30 at American Legion Post No. 1 in Omaha. She was an avid bowler for many years until ill health. She moved to the Rose about 6 years ago. Due to failing health, she went to the Rose nursing facility. She was preceded in death by her husbands, Roger Trent and Roger Warner. Sisters Gloria Faye Moss, Inez E. Rongish, Maxine Mann, and Ellen Shreves, and brothers Gary Dean, Clifford, and Ronald Moss, nieces Debbie and Dixie Shreves, and nephew David Shreves. She is survived by nieces Gloria Mattinson, Pam and Mary Rongish, all of Columbus, Neb and Linda Mann of California, and Janet Arnold of Oregon, nephews Ron and Richard Moss and Jeff Rongish, all of Colorado, John Rongish of Lincoln, Nebraska, Dennis and Doug Shreves of South Dakota, and many great nieces and nephews. Graveside services at Cedar Dale Cemetery in Papillion, Nebraska, Monday at 1 p.m. Our other obituary for the day is for Janice Elaine Weiss. Janice Elaine Weiss died October 16, 2020, in Brandondale, Florida, at the age of 86. Born on July 14, 1934 in Council Bluffs, she graduated from the University of Missouri and was the president of the Delta Gamma sorority her junior year. She earned a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Iowa at the time when few women were in the program and became a prominent figure in Minnesota higher education. A colleague stated that she held every job in the Minnesota state system except football coach. She was counselor, institutional researcher, associate dean, associate vice president chancellor, and vice chancellor. In all, she devoted 45 years in service to education at McAllister College, North Hennepin Community College, and the Minnesota state system. In retirement, she remained involved in her community. She was an avid art glass collector and active in the Southwest Florida Glass Art Alliance. She played bridge, was a member of the New Floridians and the Sarasota chapter of Phi Beta Kappa. At Freedom Village, she served on the resident council and was a representative for the Good Neighbors program. She leaves behind good friends in all the places she's lived. She is survived by three children, Robert, Amy, Shana Connolly, five grandchildren, Jorge Cecilio, Michael and Sophia Weiss, Angus and Isla Connolly, one great-grandchild, Madalena Cecilio, and twin brother Richard Henderson. At her request, no memorial service will be held. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations in her name to the Pilchuck Glass School, or Tidewell Hospice. Moving on to the sports section of the Daily Nonpareil. This article is titled, The Ones We Play For, Iowa Keeps Wave for Young Patients. There is a photo associated with this article. I'm going to read the caption. In this August 31st, 2019 file photo, Iowa fans wave to children in the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, Iowa City, Iowa. During a season when the atmosphere will be subdued at Iowa home football games because of the unusual 69,000 fans won't be there, one tradition will go on uninterrupted. At the end of the first quarter, players and coaches from both teams will turn to the University of Iowa Stead Families Children's Hospital and wave, just as they've done at every home game since 2017. Now on to the article. Home football games for the University of Iowa won't have the same roar and buzz this season because the usual 69,000 fans won't be there. One beloved tradition will go on uninterrupted. At the end of the first quarter at the home opener Saturday against Northwestern, players and coaches from both teams will turn to the nearby Stead Family Children's Hospital and wave, just as they've done every home game since 2017. One of the best, if not the best, traditions in college football is showing our appreciation and support and love for those families, children, and those healthcare providers at the Children's Hospital, said Northwestern coach Pat Fitzgerald. The wave is something I personally look forward to, and I know our players will when they get there. It's a great tradition in Big Ten sports and in college football. There's plenty of buildup for the first wave of the season, though it won't look quite the same. Fans customarily participate along with everyone on the field. But this year, the Big Ten has barred the general public from stadiums because of the COVID-19 pandemic, though families of players and staff can attend. The hospital isn't allowing group gatherings, so patients and their families can't congregate on game days in the press box, the event space on the top floor that overlooks the Kinnick Stadium. We've really had to reimagine what the tailgate party will look like, said Emily Baxter, the hospital's child life programming specialist. Though patients will stay in their rooms and watch the game on television, Baxter and other members of the hospital staff are making sure game days are just as memorable as in years past. Each patient will receive his or her own tailgate bag filled with an assortment of goodies. There's a window cling that reads, "We wave together," a commemorative ticket, and more. The ticket, which looks nearly identical to the one a fan would purchase, has blanks on the back where patients can fill in their name, room number, how their stay was, and what made their day awesome. And as the tradition goes, the patients will still wave at the end of the first quarter, just from the comfort of their own rooms, and they will get waves in return from eager players. It's always a really good feeling to look up and know we're being watched by the kids, Iowa linebacker Barrington Wade said. They're the ones we play for. The wave is definitely a thing we're all looking forward to. The football team's relationship with the hospital and its patients extends far beyond the wave, though. Players are known to venture up to the patients' rooms to hang out and play video games. They still get to interact with the patients during the pandemic, only it's over Zoom. The Child Life program also has a pair of Omni robots, which patients can control from their beds to get a virtual stadium tour. We have a great relationship with the football team, and actually with university athletics, the board, and all the different teams, Baxter said. Every Wednesday, a pair of athletes from various sports hop on Zoom from their respective facilities. They read a story to the young patients, and it's broadcast to every room through the hospital closed-circuit television program. When Iowa season was in limbo, members of the school's spirit squad and athletes from different sports would meet on the sidewalk outside the hospital every Saturday at 11:40 a.m., around the time a first quarter would end for an 11 a.m. kickoff, and wave to the patients. The wave is very community-sponsored, Baxter said. It's not something we, as the hospital, put on. It's been very organic. It's fun to watch what people come up with. The patients want to offer encouragement too. Each Friday before the game, the football team receives a video with a patient sending a pump-up message. Those kids up there, they're going through the things in their daily life that make our problems, like losing a football game, seem pretty small, Iowa defensive back Jack Corner said. The wave is something we've been lucky enough to participate in, and really something I always look forward to. And I know that the kids up there love it. We love that we can put a smile on their faces. Next in sport news, we have the MLB. White Sox reunite with La Russa, hire Hall of Fame manager. Tony La Russa didn't envision returning to the dugout when he stood at the podium in Cooperstown 6 years ago and took his place alongside baseball's greats. That started to change the past few seasons, and he simply couldn't resist the opportunity the Chicago White Sox gave him. La Russa, the Hall of Famer who won a World Series with the Oakland Athletics and two more with the St. Louis Cardinals, is returning to manage the White Sox, 34 years after they fired him. The 76-year-old La Russa rejoins the franchise where his big league managing career began more than four decades ago. He takes over for Rick Renteria, after what the White Sox insisted was a mutual agreement to split. How rare is it to get the opportunity to manage a team that's as talented and this close to winning? La Russa said. Most of the time, your chances are the opposite. The combination of looking forward to getting back down there and the White Sox making the call with a chance to win sooner rather than later. I'm excited that they made that choice and looking forward to what's ahead. La Russa inherits a team loaded with young stars and productive veterans that reached the postseason for the first time since 2008, only to sputter down the stretch and get knocked out in the wild card round. The White Sox have never made back-to-back playoff appearances, but after ending a string of seven losing seasons, they are in position to change that. La Russa becomes the oldest manager in the major league by 5 years. Houston's Dusty Baker is 71. La Russa, who started his managing career with the White Sox during the 1979 season, is returning to the dugout for the first time since 2011, when he led St. Louis past Texas in the World Series. He also won championships with Oakland in 1989 and the Cardinals in 2006. La Russa is 2,728 to 2,365, with six pennants over 33 seasons with Chicago. Oakland and St. Louis. He was enshrined in Cooperstown in 2014. Only Hall of Famers Connie Mack and John McGraw have more victories. He and Sparky Anderson are the only managers to win World Series in the American and National Leagues. La Russa got his first major league managing job at age 34 when the White Sox prompted him from AAA to replace the fired Don Kessinger. He took over that August and led them to 522-510 record over parts of the eight seasons. The 1983 team won 99 games on the way to the AL West Championship. Chicago's first playoff experience since 1959, Go-Go White Sox won the pennant. But he was fired in 1986 by then-general manager Ken Harrelson after the White Sox got off to a 26-38 start. Chairman Jerry Reinsdorf has long regretted allowing that move and remains close with La Russa. Now with the reuniting, his hiring is not based on friendship or on what happened years ago, but on the fact that we have the opportunity to have one of the greatest managers in the game's history in our dugout at the time when we believe our team is poised for great accomplishments, Reinsdorf said in a statement. The move is a surprise considering how long it's been since La Russa was in the first dugout. General manager Rick Hahn had said the White Sox were looking for someone who has experience with the championship organization in recent years. Former Houston manager A.J. Hinch and ex-Boston skipper Alex Cora fit that description, Both were suspended by Major League Baseball for the 2020 season for their roles in the Astros sign-stealing scandal, and both lost their manager jobs. Their punishments ended this week. Hahn insisted it was a consensus decision between him, Reinsdorf, and Executive Vice President Ken Williams to go with La Russa. Tony was the choice because it's believed that Tony is the best man to help us win championships over the next several years and usher us into what we expect to be a very exciting phase for the White Sox baseball, Hahn said. Though he hasn't managed in 9 years, La Russa has remained a part of the game. Shortly after retiring, he went to work in the league office for 2 years, assisting former Yankees manager Dotor in on-field discipline issues. In May 2014, he was hired by the Arizona Diamondbacks to oversee their baseball operation. They signed Jack Greinke to a $206.5 million deal following the 2015 season. La Russa got demoted to advisory role for following a 93-loss season in 2016 and joined Boston's front office as special assistant to then-president Dave Dombrowski in November 2017. La Russa was with the Red Sox when they hired Cora and won the World Series in 2018, and he spent his last season as a senior advisor for baseball operations with the Los Angeles Angels, assisting in player development. Whether any of manager Joe Maddon's fun-loving ways rubbed off on him remains to be seen. La Russa, of course, was known for his scowl, then a smile. Now he's taken on a vibrant and outgoing team where sky-high bat flips by Tim Anderson seem almost as common as pop flies. Then again, his closer in Oakland, Dennis Eckersley, was known to pump his fist, point at opponents and fire imaginary guns at them after strikeouts. If I see that it's sincere and it's directed toward the game, that's the display and kind of emotion that you want, La Russa said. As a coach, what you want to do is you want to get players passionately involved with the competition. And if you do that, you get exciting games. You're entertaining. La Russa also said his views on athletes kneeling during the national anthem to protest social injustice have evolved. He criticized then San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick in several interviews in 2016, questioning his sincerity and accusing him of disrespecting the flag. The White Sox had several players kneel this past season, including Anderson and stars Jose Abreu and Lucas Giolito. I know in 2016 when the issue first occurred, my initial instincts were all about respecting the flag and the anthem and what America stands for, La Russa said. There's been a lot that goes on in a very healthy way since 2016. Not only do I respect, but I applaud the awareness that comes into not just society, but especially in sports. If you talk specifically baseball, I applaud and would support the fact that they are now identifying the injustices, especially on the racial side. This next article is about the Atlanta Falcons. Ryan, Falcons avenge earlier loss to Panthers, 25-17. Matt Ryan threw for 281 yards and ran for a touchdown. Younghoe Koo made 4 field goals, and the Atlanta Falcons held on to beat the Carolina Panthers 25-17 on Thursday night to avoid a series season sweep. The Falcons 2-6 have had a penchant for squandering leads this season, coming into the game 1-3 when leading entering the fourth quarterback. Carolina was driving late, but Atlanta stalled the rally when Blitty Ray Wilson intercepted Teddy Bridgewater near the Falcons' 10-yard line with 1 minute and 4 seconds remaining. Todd Gurley grinded out 46 yards rushing and a touchdown. Julio Jones added 137 yards receiving, and Falcons' defense limited the Panthers to 2 of 10 on the third down conversions to improve to 2-1 since Raheem Morris replaced Dan Quinn as head coach. The win came in The win came in front of a crowd of 5,240 due to COVID-19. This next article is pertaining to the entertainment section. This article is called Judge Judy to Move Her Gavel to Streaming Service IMDb TV. Everybody's going to be streaming, including Judge Judy. The broadcast TV staple next act will be IMDb TV, Amazon's free digital service. Judith Scheindlin, whose long-running syndicated courtroom show Judge Judy will end production in 2021, will be dispensing justice on an exclusive show in the U.S. for IMDb TV. It was announced Thursday. I'm over the moon to be in business with Amazon Studios, and continuing this incredible journey with them on a new platform is so exciting, Scheindlin said in a statement. The title and debut date for the new courtroom show were not announced. The untitled Judge Judy Scheindlin project will feature no-nonsense, expeditious Judge Scheindlin's signature adjudication style with a new array of cases, litigants, and judgments, according to the announcement. Last March, Scheindlin said Judge Judy was debuted in 1996, would end production in 2021, but the show will continue to be shown through a two-year deal that CBS made with stations that currently carry Judge Judy to air reruns of the program. The tough-talking former New York family court judge's popularity made for the highest-paid personality in TV. When Scheindlin announced her eventual departure from Judge Judy on the Ellen DeGeneres talk show, she also said another show was ahead. If you're not tired, you're not supposed to stop, Scheindlin, 78, told DeGeneres. Now we have an article titled, Two Same-Sex Couples in Military Marry in First for Taiwan. Two lesbian couples tied the knot in a mass wedding held by Taiwan's military on Friday in a historic celebration with their peers. Taiwan is the only place in Asia to have legalized same-sex marriage, with more than 4,000 such couples marrying since the legislation passed in May 2019. The mass wedding with 188 couples was the first time same-sex couples that have been wed and celebrated at the military ceremony. Both couples viewed their ceremonies with a sense of responsibility towards representing the LGBT community. We are hoping that more LGBT people in the military can bravely stand up because our military is very open-minded. In matters of love, everyone will be treated equally, says Chen Ying Husan, an Army lieutenant who married Li Lichen, 26. Chen wore a rainbow wristband and said that she always been open about her sexual orientation while serving. Their ceremony at an Army base in the northern city of Taiwan was brief. The couples took part in a parade and then exchanged rings in front of an audience of family members and their senior officers. Yumi Ming, 37, and her wife, Army Major Wang Yi, 36, wiped back tears as they exchanged rings. Ming wore sneakers under her wedding dress, while Wang wore her officer's uniform. They carried a pride flag throughout the ceremony. Ming's parents had not come to the celebration, but in support, both of Wang's parents, as well as her teacher, came out to support the couple. I really feel that this is a huge breakthrough for the military, because before gay people really had to go through a lot, said Amy Chow, mother to Wang. Perhaps for heterosexual couples, it's just a paper, but it's very important for gay couples. If you're sick or have to have major surgery, if you don't have this, then you are nothing. You can't make a decision. Since same-sex couples became legal in Taiwan, 4,021 couples have married, with 69% of them lesbian couples, according to the most recent government data. The military seemed an unlikely institution to be the site of a same-sex marriage, but in recent years has opened up, said Victoria Hugh, the co-founder of the Taiwan Alliance to Promote Civil Partnership Rights. We hope this is a good sign to show that the armed forces' attitude toward the LGBT community is becoming more supportive than before in Taiwan. The attitude was on full display Friday as it welcomed dozens of reporters to the wedding. Our attitude is that everyone should be treated equally as we congratulate each and every couple, and this shows our military's position is open-minded, progressive, and with the times, Lieutenant General Yang An told reporters at the wedding. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, October 30th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers would love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Rachel from Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you for listening.